Hi, this is Aspen Grinder. I'm in Topeka, Kansas. The date is March 29th, 2016. I'm joined here by Reverend Sarah Oglesby Dunnigan. I pronounced that correctly. Great. I'm at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and I'll read this statement of consent and ask you whether you agree or not. The Department of Religious Studies at the University of Kansas is conducting a research project that seeks to preserve the history of various churches and other religious organizations in Kansas. We would like to record your memories of your experiences in religious organizations. We expect that each interview will take about an hour, so about 30 minutes to an hour is the usual range. We assure you that you are not obligated to participate and may discontinue your involvement at any time. Since we are trying to create a public record of Kansas religious history, we are primarily interviewing persons who agree to let their interviews be available to the general public through a website and to be identified by name as the person who was interviewed. Should you have any questions about the project, please contact Professor Tim Miller. I can provide you with his contact information if you'd like. If you have any questions about your rights as a research participant, you may call the Human Subjects Protection Office, and I can provide you with that information as well. So could you briefly introduce yourself and, you know, your role here?
Sure. I'm Sarah Oglesby Dunnigan, Reverend. I am the sole minister at a small fellowship here in Topeka. I serve about 150 people.
Great. And, well, I guess a good place to start would be, could you tell me a bit about your upbringing, so your youth and then your religious involvement as a child and things like that?
Sure. So both my parents are currently teachers. My dad was an English teacher for high school, and he taught the Bible as lit. He's an atheist. So my mother was, she worked in public administration for her first career and then ended up in creative writing and teaches in a university setting now as a professor. Until I was a young adult, I had really almost no church experience at all. I was unchurched, as they say. Part of my family was Catholic from the Minnesota area. My great-grandparents and that part of my family all stayed Catholic. My grandmother married a man who'd been divorced and in the 40s, and they were excommunicated from the church at that time, so they became Methodists. I don't know that they went to church frequently at all. They had seven kids on my mom's side. My dad's side, mostly Presbyterian. they go to church some. So, you know, when I visited other people's families and spent the night on a Saturday night, I might end up at somebody's church on Sunday morning. That was probably, and occasionally we would go to a congregational church in Colorado Springs for Christmas or Easter with grandparents, but for the most part, totally unchurched. I'd say my dad definitely identifies as atheist. He went to seminary for a year in Boston and actually dropped out. He and my mother had both grown up to be Methodists and had gone to youth stuff as Methodists, you know, high school students, and had done young adult stuff as Methodists. But he started seminary and realized pretty quickly that he didn't actually believe in God. I don't know how he didn't find the Unitarians then. He was right there in Boston. And he loves the Transcendentalists. Those are some of his favorite people to teach as an English teacher. But he didn't discover that, and he didn't become a UU minister. My mom actually discovered the Unitarian Fellowship in Denton, Texas, when she moved there to be a professor of creative writing in English in 1992 or 1993. She talked to other people around town, and they said, you know, all the people from out of town go to the Unitarian Church, pretty much indicating that you're in Texas now and you are expected to go to church somewhere. And even the Unitarian Church sort of qualifies you as having a home, a religious home.
As long as it's a church.
As long as, you know, it's...
Just pick you.
Yeah. So she ended up going there, and I moved there a year later. I was a junior in college, just turned 21. And I started going to, they had a women's group that met twice a month in the evening. Actual church service was way too early. My initial expectation was, the reason there's no young adults here is because you all do this at 10 o'clock in the morning. What's wrong with you? But I went to the women's group, and it was all women my mom's age, but they were really fun, and they were exploring the feminine divine and ritual, and it was awesome. I loved it. I think they cajoled me into going to service at some point because it was a partially lay-led congregation, so they had a minister twice a month, and they led their own services twice a month, which meant groups like the women's group volunteered to take a service here and there. So I think I got pulled into doing one of those early Sunday services through that. And I ended up liking it and occasionally going. I'm not sure that I was real regular at first. So I was 21 before I had any kind of religious anything. I've been a Unitarian Universalist since then.
Mm-hmm. So that was the beginning of it all.
22, 23 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you become kind of actively involved?
Probably about a year or two in. I ended up working with the high school youth at that time. Taught a class with them, helped them lead a couple services. I can't remember exactly what all I did. I served on the board at one point, as a young adult. Don't think that I probably pledged very much money. I didn't have very much money to pledge. Got married for the first time in that church when I was 23. So I was pretty active. And then probably inactive for a little while. We moved into the Dallas area. I had a job in Dallas. And then I ended up being a member at... I'm visiting different churches and being a member at a couple different churches back then.
Mm-hmm.
So, kind of moved around in the Southwest District.
Mm-hmm. Do you attend a variety of church services, or do you like to sit in on other, congregational meetings, or are you so busy here that you... Yeah,
you know, I would love to. When I get the chance to visit somebody else's church on a Sunday, I do. I do have the Sunday off a month, but I haven't yet used that to go to somebody else's church in town. I'm usually sleeping in and enjoying my family. But before I became a minister, I went to a lot of different UU churches, partly because so in 2001, I visited El Salvador, and I learned about microcredit programs. So for a couple years after that, I traveled and shared with different churches about microcredit and how they could invest in microcredit programs, and did little workshops, and for some churches that was actually their Sunday sermon, was me talking about microcredit. And then later I went to, in 2006, I went to Guatemala to learn about fair trade coffee and how it was connected to the human rights efforts in Guatemala. And I did the same thing. I spent a couple of years sharing that information with other churches, how selling fair trade coffee at their church could make a difference for people in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of it. Got involved. The Southwest District for Unitarian Universalism has a annual women's conference, and I went pretty regularly to that. I met women from all over that district, and so that was pretty fun. My mom and I went together for a number of years, and then when I started having kids, I took my oldest to it a couple times when she was a baby, and then that got unmanageable. So, yeah.
Could you tell me a bit more about the Guatemalan fair trade experience? I read a little bit about that online.
Sure. Sure. The Unitarian Universal Service Committee does a number of different trips to help people learn about human rights issues around the world. And one of the ones that they do is got to do with learning about fair trade coffee. They do it in several different countries. I happen to go to the one in Guatemala, but they have one in Haiti and I think one in Africa too. I'm not sure. But... it was a group of mostly Unitarians, but it wasn't just Unitarians, because that's considered to be a secular committee service, just like the American Friends Service Committee is also sort of a secular organization that does work that's funded by so it's funded by UUs, but it's not just a UU organization. We had probably 20 people that went down. It's been about 7 to 10 days. I don't remember exactly how long. And we got to see and learn about the whole process of how coffee gets taken to market. But we also met with a number of different human rights organizations that were fighting for land rights down there and how land rights is connected back to fair trade.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was that you'd be able to come back and and advocate to people why fair trade was an important way to purchase things, why it makes a difference for people, why paying more for a fair trade product is worth it, what that extra money is going towards. So that was fascinating because we met with, we actually lived a couple days up in the mountains with families that were part of the co-op that we were visiting, and got to see how they lived and see how, you know, we got to pick coffee and just get a sense of what difference did it make in their lives to be part of the co-op.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty life-changing and fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I gather from, you know, reading a little bit about you online and speaking with you today that, you know, human rights and social justice and environmental issues are very important for you and, you know, for others who attend services here as well. Do you think that that's something that is maybe not emphasized enough in many denominations or religious faiths, or something that should be focused on more?
Well, I think we have a lot of really important partners that do justice work with us. So I think for many people live out their faith through justice work. So I don't know that I would say it's not emphasized enough. I do think there's a sort of version of Christianity right now that's very focused on sort of the gospel of wealth and the gospel of feeling good about yourself. I don't agree with that, but I see a lot of liberal Christians and even Catholics working very hard to make the world a better place, and motivated by their belief in Christ and their belief in biblical text that supports their idea that this is the right thing to do, this is what Jesus would do. So I don't think we're more or less. I think we do it not because we're necessarily following the work of Jesus, but because it's ethical. I mean, I think we're a lot more like Jews that way. This is an ethical way of living. And it's not to please our God, but because it's the right thing to do. And for some people in this community, there is a connection back to the holy, that this is holy work that feeds our spirit. I definitely think that spiritual and justice work are connected and need to be. That you need to have a spiritual practice that grounds you, that keeps, I mean, I do. I need to have space and time that is reflective, that is not doing something, but is being and connecting with myself, with my environment, with other people. So that when I go out to do justice work, I'm not overwhelmed by the pain and suffering of the world in a way that takes me out of the game. So I actually think that there's a balance issue in my context, that a lot of people want to do stuff, but they're not as good at focusing on who they're being. And people tend to be more comfortable in one camp or the other, right? So my folks who love going to meditation and love the being piece, the working on my who I'm being in the world piece, are sometimes really uncomfortable with the doing piece of justice work, because it roils up your emotions and gets you entangled in things that feel sometimes overwhelming. But I think in order to do justice work well, you can't sit through some of the stuff that happens in the legislature and walk out a normal human being if you don't have a spiritual practice and a grounding of some kind, whether it's your faith in God and Christ, or whether it's your sense of Buddhist interbeing, or, you know, however you get there, you need that spiritual grounding, in my opinion. So, I am so lucky to have the other ministers in this town from other faith traditions that work hard to show up in the Capitol on the same issues that I do. They don't all show up for all the same issues I do. You know, I have my partners who, you know, there's the folks who are liberal like us and will stand up for women's choice. There's people who stand up for the environment. There's people who stand up for ending gun violence. It's different groups of people, but there are a lot of people in this town from different faith traditions that are moved by that tradition to do that work. So,
and since you've moved to Kansas and into Topeka, are there any major projects or work that you see that needs to be done in the community here that needs to be focused on?
Yeah, what I'm seeing right now, and it's not just in Kansas, it's in a number of states that have had this sort of super conservative push towards... It's interesting. So have you followed the work of William Barber that did the Moral Mondays work in North Carolina?
No.
Okay. He's amazing. You should totally read him. So he's a black minister that started this movement in North Carolina around pointing out to the state legislature that what they were doing was actually not moral. You know, underfunding education, not funding access to health care, making sure people have guns before they have access to other basic needs, undermining voting rights. So that pattern and the kinds of legislation that are coming with them, it's a cookie-cutter pattern that's showing up in a number of states that has been designed. I mean, it's the same stuff. It's ALEC bills that are look exactly the same in every state. Sometimes the legislators, you know, peel away pieces of them, but it's the same legislation being introduced. I see the need for us to do something that Barber calls fusion politics, which is bringing together all of these different constituencies to see that they are each other's allies. Barber made this point of saying in his state, you know, the anti-LGBTQ legislation is a distraction. It's made to prevent us from being in allyship with these other groups of people, and we need to not let it be that. It's a civil rights issue the same way that race is a civil rights issue, and he was able to pull on African-American churches to follow him and agree to that because he was able to show them the direct connection. So I think what I see needs to happen in Kansas is that people of faith need to point out what's not moral. And it's not moral whether you're Muslim, whether you're Christian, whether you're Jewish, whether you're pagan. It's not moral what we're doing to people. And we need to be able to stand up for those issues as one movement and not as separate entities that that get caught up in distracting issues like what bathroom you use. Mm-hmm. And do you look cisgender or are you transgender? And what parts are you actually walking around with? And that's a complete distraction issue meant to keep us from looking at, oh, by the way, your schools might not open in the fall because we've made this unconstitutional situation with our how we fund them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's sort of everything and all. I see all of those issues as interconnected. I'm willing to show up on behalf of those issues, and I've been working hard actually to meet people, you know, meet the different constituencies from these different groups so that there'll be enough relationship that when one of us is showing up in the Capitol, we can invite people from the other groups to show up.
Mm-hmm. What kind of reaction have you sensed?
There's a hunger for it.
Mm-hmm.
The organization that I ended up being on the board of, Kansas Interfaith Action, which is a retooling of Kansas Interfaith Power Line. So we looked at it and said, look, environment's really important, but we're getting nowhere with it, and there's all this other stuff happening in our state that's really undermining our ability to function at all. And as pastors, we can't just work on the environment. We have people in our congregations that are hurting from this other stuff that's going on, so we need to broaden our approach. I find that many of the people of faith that I've talked to are hungering for this connectiveness, this understanding of how these things are connected, and they want to see it modeled. How do you show up and do justice works? For the people who have not stepped out and done justice work, they want to see it modeled in a way that's inclusive of their beliefs and their leadership.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's not always easy to do.
Right.
I mean, my congregation's been very visible in LGBTQ rights, but that's not the only thing that we fight for. We've just been one of the most visible ones because we don't bump up against anything in our tradition around that issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's us and the Congregationalists often standing up for that. But you know, Presbyterians, some liberal Presbyterians have shown up for those issues too. So a lot of it has to do with who your pastor is, what part of the country you're in, what's the makeup of your congregation.
Mm-hmm.
Those things make a really big difference in whether your congregation feels like it should show up for stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We have a history of doing work in El Salvador with the congregation across the street. and Tapatates. So, I mean, I think people hunger to do work together. They hunger for the partnerships. They hunger to know more about each other and to not be... I think this... There's been a time period where we've all been sort of these separate little in-facing congregations where all I'm worried about is taking care of my congregation. How am I going to serve my people? What do my people need? And now we're starting to look up and see, well, there's overlap between my people and your people. And they're really all our people. And we need to be in relationship with each other, congregation to congregation. Not just you congregation to you congregation, but congregation to congregation. You know, congregation to Beth Shalom congregation. Mm-hmm. We need to have those ties be deeper and those relationships be real.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know where I was going with that, but...
And could you talk a little bit about your congregation specifically and sort of what kind of environment you hope to provide and what it's like, basically, what...
So this particular congregation is a lot of folks who work in different levels of education and state leadership. Obviously, we're in the state capital. So folks who've been working for the government, state or federal or school district.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of social workers, a lot of healthcare folks in my congregation. So... not very blue collar, but not super high level professional either.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of very middle class, very middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And so struggling, some folks just really struggling because their nonprofit organization or the government entity they work for is also struggling.
Mm-hmm.
My congregation has a history of working with AIDS and with the LGBTQ community. Over time, they've one of the first, the AIDS Project here in Topeka came out of this congregation, and people in here, current work in this community around those issues, a lot of my people are on boards and such connected to that. So when Menninger was here and was doing, helping people with physical transition, gender transition, a lot of those folks came to church here while they were recovering. This was the safe place for them to come be in community and be taken care of and loved on until they went back home to wherever they had come from to do that. So this congregation has a unique history that way, a unique connection, and they feel pretty strongly about it.
Mm-hmm.
And the first identified AIDS congregation and a couple other communities that were connected to him brought him food, took him to doctor's appointments, sat with him and read with him, et cetera, until he died.
Mm-hmm.
And so our sanctuary is named after him. And it was a group of maybe 30 or 40 people originally,
mm-hmm.
you know, 20 or 30 originally. It sort of grew and grew. They didn't have any kids or religious exploration, and then some of those couples had kids, and they had to figure out what are we doing with our kids, because now there's more than two or three running around, now there's 10, and they're kind of disruptive, what do we do with them?
Mm-hmm.
And they developed a religious exploration program for the kids, sort of just because they had to. And so, you know, they started growing. They had part-time ministry for a few years. They shared a minister with the Manhattan congregation for a little while. And then they had a full-time minister for about 8 years, and then an interim when she left for 2 years. So about 10 years of full-time ministry before I came on.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to that, they'd had about three-quarters time ministry for a few years. So.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who came here from the congregation in Des Moines, which is a much bigger congregation, said to me, "You guys are small but mighty." And I would say that this congregation is involved in, like, an unbelievable amount of things in the community. I bump into my people everywhere. I couldn't even hide from them if I wanted to, because they're on the boards of different organizations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're making gardens with people. They're just kind of all over. They're very politically active, but very socially active. And most of them have lived here in Topeka for most of their professional lives, so they're very interconnected in the community. This is probably the most welcoming congregation I have ever been in. You know, some every congregation when you enter it has its own kind of feel. Mm-hmm. Some of them it like takes a while to warm up. Mm-hmm. People won't talk to you right away, or people will talk to you but they don't invite you to anything right away, or you know, I mean every congregation's got kind of its feel. Mm-hmm. This congregation has a number of young families, young adults, not young adults, but you know, late 20s.
That one's you.
That's me. Late 20s to early 30s, we have a number of small families that have joined. And we have a ton of baby boomers, so that's kind of normal. Most churches right now are struggling with lots of baby boomers and not enough of the sort of middle-aged people like me mm-hmm. and younger people between your age and 30s that gives it some balance and some different structure. Mm-hmm. So I think that we have a greater mix than most congregations our size, and so that's helped lead to a lot more energy for the most part. Mm-hmm. It also pushes you to change how you do stuff, because younger people come into church settings and either they've been unchurched or they didn't like church, and so if what you're doing feels too churchy, it feels weird. Mm-hmm. And so they're like, why are we singing this? Or, right. You know, that was an awkward little ritual you just did. So, I mean, your young adults are, they're going to read how things happen differently. Mm-hmm. But because this church has such a strong secular humanist background, there's also a pushback against anything that feels too spiritual by my older people. Mm-hmm. Whereas my younger people hunger for the spiritual stuff. They just don't get all the kind of containers that things get put in. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Strongly humanist, but a lot more religious humanist. So folks who are, we have two different Buddhist meditation groups that meet here. Mm. We have a yoga group that meets regularly that are led by members. Few people who identify with some sort of Sufi Muslim background. Mm. A few people who are married to somebody who's Jewish, so the couple's been one or both. Some people who grew up in the Unitarian tradition who are here. But a lot of people who came from other traditions and found this because where they were at just didn't fit. Mm-hmm. One of my young families showed up here because they have a kid who's not cisgender and doesn't fit in, and biologically a boy that dresses like a girl, wants to be called she. And is that family was looking for a place that would be welcoming and okay with that. And this congregation was like, we don't care what your kid wears. Mm-hmm. We don't care what pronoun your kid wants. We're going to love on your kid however they show up. And we do that for the adults, too. I have had a couple of adults who have been transitioning one gender to the other. And this is a welcoming place for people to show up, where maybe in other parts of their life, there's a lot of tension around that. And here people can do that, and I tell people in my welcome, we'll let you choose the pronoun you want us to use. It's you take the lead. You mm-hmm. tell me. And so, I don't know. What else do you want me to tell you about our congregation?
Well, I mean, obviously in a lot of religious institutions, there's kind of a focus or an aim for consensus. And, of course, here, I mean, I get the sense that diversity is key, creating a diverse environment. So what do you think that kind of brings to individual and collective religious experiences and spiritual journeys? Maybe speaking from your own experience.
That's a great question. That's sort of the crux of the matter. So we are a pluralistic tradition. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, I gave you the little card that has the principles and purposes in our order of service, too. Mm-hmm. So there's our principles. And then we draw from the sources of world religion, and as well as lived experience, and as well as, so here's the sources. Mm-hmm. And so, and if you look at our hymnal, you'll see that we have readings from all over that range of capacity, right? So all of those different sources, all of those different ideas about what it is to be have inherent worth and dignity. I like to say the theological piece of that is sort of all souls are sacred and worthy. I frame it as this is a sacred circle. We are in covenant with one another to be in relationship. your journey is yours. And so the rituals and words that you use to make your journey meaningful, you get to choose. And we might choose radically different things. But our commitment is to be in relationship and to be in the sacred circle together. And to make that sacred circle as permeable as it can be, without violating somebody else's inherent worth and dignity. You know, we believe in the use of the democratic process as a really important piece. So all of our congregations use that to, you know, choose a board. And most congregationally based congregation, you know, the Baptists use that too. That's not a theological statement, except that for us it kind of is. Because it says that all people should have a voice in things that affect their life. And so I'm going to stand up for you if you don't have a voice in something that affects the course of your life. Mm-hmm. Because I believe that that's a right that you have that's inherent. Mm-hmm. So the way it gets complicated, though, is if I'm a theist and I'm preaching and I use the word God or holy or spirit of life, and you're a strong secular humanist, that language might not sit well with you. Or if I do a prayer instead of a meditation and you're a person who likes to sit and be with silence and I'm talking, you know, so creating ritual that speaks to all of those needs, speaks to... there's a high craving here for intellectual inquiry, probably higher than spiritual. There's a strong also current for the need for spiritual inquiry. And so trying to figure out how to blend the spiritual and the intellectual with the actual experiential, how do we actually experience the holy? That can be complicated for how you plan both a Sunday service, but also what you plan for in between Sundays. We have several small group ministry activities called Chalice Circles, and they work. My ministry as well as the small groups work from a theme. So we have a monthly theme. This last month has been liberation. Next month is creation. And the question is, what does it mean to be a people of liberation, or what does it mean to be a people of creation? And we use a really wide range of materials to get at that idea. And so my services have that, but then also our small group inquiry has spiritual practices and sort of a more personal, intense, intimate conversation about how that's showing up in your life. And then I have a more intellectual inquiry once a month called the Forum, where we will have dinner and talk about it in a more conversational way than the small group ministry does. I guess for me, holding that pluralism is being able to say to my secular humanist, it's okay for somebody to use the word God. And for my person who is moved by the life of Jesus to say, it's okay for somebody to not believe in the incarnation of Jesus as Christ. That we can sit in the same circle together. I think most people who strongly connect with the Christian message are more likely, but want some of that looseness, are more likely to show up in a congregational or UCC church because they get that, but they also have our covenantal. I mean, they have the same sort of covenantal, non-creedal piece, so that you could be kind of still on your own path, still discovering, still searching, but you have this orienting Christian piece, and we have a much broader piece. I don't know. My husband grew up Catholic, and he loves the ethical idea piece, the intellectual piece, the values piece to this. For him, there's not enough ritual. He misses the ritual of being Catholic. I didn't grow up with any religion. Sometimes this is more ritual than what I'm up for. Right? So... holding all that pluralism and figuring out, giving people this space to figure out how to make that work for them. And then creating enough different, you know, we joke with people, if you didn't like this Sunday, come about three or four more times. Because it's radically different in terms of what we talk about. You know, the structure is mostly the same, but sometimes I mess with the structure too. Like the solstice service. So you might come in and have, we did a storytelling service at the beginning of spring break, and people of all different ages, is intergenerational, so people of all different ages came in and told different stories. So we did the offering and we sang a couple songs, but there was no sermon. So somebody, if that was their first Sunday, I would definitely say, you know, come two or three more times so you can see the range of what we do, because this is one version of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that helps the answer about the pluralism.
No, I think it does.
There's always somebody who's not going to like it or disagree with me. I don't think that's different in other churches, though, right? Mm-hmm, I mean, right. I think we presume that we are all more on the same page because we are all at the Presbyterian church. Then actually, if you were to talk to everybody in that church, you're going to find the atheists. You're going to find the people who didn't believe that, but who liked the person sitting next to them and came with them, mm-hmm. or who liked the music, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And in general, I suppose in the U.S. in general, but also maybe here in Kansas as well, do you notice kind of an increasing desire for a less dogmatic, strict religious approach and more of an accepting, liberal kind of approach? Do you think that's kind of a growing thing?
I mean, I guess I hope for that.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a lot of people show up that are looking for something different and have stayed. So the people who come here and stayed, that's definitely what they communicated they were looking for. How big a number is that out there? I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who don't see the possibilities that a church community could bring for them. My sense is that a lot of young adults... I just happened upon this. I wasn't looking for it when I was 21. Maybe I was looking for it. I didn't know I was looking for it, for sure. I didn't know that there was a group, that the idea of being part of a church meant that there would be somebody who would be there for me when I lost somebody that was important to me, you know, when somebody died, that there would be people to grieve with me or to walk with me when I was really ill, or to show up and give my husband rides to physical therapy after he'd had surgery, or to come visit us in the hospital when my daughter's in ICU. I think most of us rely on our friends and family for that stuff, but we don't realize that sometimes that system's not big enough to hold what we walk through in our life. The questions we have, the difficulties we have with marriage or with kids, or I mean, there's a number of things that I've heard people tell me, being in this community for 30 or 40 years, that their friends and family wouldn't have been enough. And they were important to them, but they wouldn't have been enough to get them through those situations. And I think a lot of people don't, you know, they're rejecting the doctrine or the dogma of a church, but the structure of that, what I think of as the sacred circle, there's something really elemental and beautiful about that when it works, when it's functioning, when it's healthy. And I hate the idea that we might lose that. So I hope there's people out there looking for sort of the non-creedal, non-dogmatic, sacred circle space of people who will walk with them through their life. You know, from when... And it might not be the same congregation, but maybe it's on the broader scale the same congregation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get people from other churches that come and go, but... So I hope there's people out there. I think the young people I've met who've come and joined here, who have small young families, have said to me, I don't want my kids to learn the stuff they're going to learn in the church I grew up in.
Mm.
You know, the stuff that's anti-woman, the stuff that's authoritarian, the stuff that says you're not good if you're gay or you're trans or you're whatever. They don't want their kids to grow up with that, but they... By themselves, how can you create for your kids by yourself the experience of religious exploration, really understanding the wide range of your spiritual and religious capacity as a human being, that it's pretty hard to recreate as a parent by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't do it.
Right.
I mean, I love that there's some place that talks to my kid about what it means to be a good human being,
mm-hmm.
and how will she live her life out as a good human being,
mm-hmm.
how will she treat other people. So,
do you think that most people who attend have had prior experience with the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, or coming from another tradition because they're looking for something different?
In this congregation, many people have come from another tradition altogether, mm-hmm. and have either rejected it or didn't quite fit in,
mm.
or were just looking to try something new. Some people grew up in it. I mean, I had at least one member here who was fourth generation Unitarian.
Mm-hmm.
So that's there's certainly some people who grew up this way, or who were in a UU congregation in another state and moved here and looked for the first UU they could find. That's common. If you've been in a Unitarian fellowship or church somewhere else and you liked it, if you move somewhere, that's probably the first place you're going to go look,
mm-hmm.
especially if you don't strongly identify as a Christian. Because
mm-hmm.
where else are you going to go that's church but not church? Right? That's not going to ask you to believe in that. I mean, if you're not Jewish, you're not going to just randomly show up at temple. I think most people would be pretty comfortable in temple. I think most of my people would find temple to be pretty doable. Many of them aren't theists, so they would maybe bump into that, but you know, I don't know that very many Jews are actually theists either, so. Maybe the ones that go to temple are, I don't know. Yeah.
I know we spoke about this before, but I don't remember if the recording was going on, about how you ended up in Kansas.
So it was pretty accidental. I just happened to be setting up my online ministerial record, so churches could look at me and I could go into search and the fault was me. And I noticed that this congregation hadn't filled their post and that only one person had indicated interest. So I knew there wasn't like a line of people trying to get this job. And I looked at their congregational record. It was pretty, it was a good fit for me. This congregation comes out of the fellowship movement. I've been a member of several fellowships of different sizes, from about 40 members to 250 members. So I understand how that shapes a congregation differently than one that was never a fellowship. They tend to be more secular humanist. They tend to be more interested in what I call shared ministry. They don't really want the minister to do it all herself. They are interested in sharing that role. And I'm comfortable with that. And there's definitely ministers that are not. So I saw that and I thought, well, I don't know. I need a job. This looks like a good fit. I wasn't planning to be in search yet, but what the heck, let's try it out. And after they interviewed me, they said several things that made me think, okay, I'm willing to go the next step. So it was an interview and then pre-candidating weekend where I was here Friday through Sunday and I preached in a neutral pulpit in Lawrence. The committee got to watch me. So it was like a weekend-long interview. And I liked Topeka. I'd been in Lawrence. I have family in Wichita. I've been in western Kansas, which I'm not interested in. And I kind of liked Topeka. There were some kind of funky, cool pieces to it. So, and it was an affordable place to live. So my husband started looking for jobs as well. And then we do a week-long candidating where you preach a Sunday. You spend a whole week in different interviews with different parts of the community. And then you preach the second Sunday. Then they vote whether they're going to hire you. And you need to have 93% to 95% of the congregation say yes to be hired. I had a 100%. So nobody voted against. That was great. That's almost unheard of in a congregation like this. And we moved. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of last minute, kind of unexpected, not part of the normal sort of process. But
mm-hmm. How long had you known that you wanted to have the role of minister, or did you just want to be involved in the church in some way?
That's a good question. When I started seminary, I spent 13 years in community colleges, and I'd done a lot of justice work. I think I originally thought I would be doing community ministry of some kind, probably working for a nonprofit as an executive director, but bringing more spiritual stuff into that work, more spiritual grounding. About 2 months into my internship with the congregation that I served for 10 months, I was clear that I wanted to serve a congregation. Most people who knew me at that time were surprised that I hadn't figured that out yet, because they all saw that that's what I was going to be good at.
Mm-hmm.
There are some congregations that are less justice-oriented. This congregation is super justice-oriented, probably because they're in the Capitol. I definitely was looking for a congregation that was going to allow me to be an organizer and activist, as well as, you know, somebody who brought sermons and spiritual practice and other stuff to the table.
Let's see. I had read something about you working in some kind of group in jail mm-hmm. in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
How was that? What kind of work did you do there?
So the community college I worked for in Dallas had a special jail program where mm-hmm. they taught courses towards a couple of their certificates in the jail. And one of the roles that was missing was, they couldn't have access to an advisor the same way students coming in, you know, from other places could go in and sit down with an advisor. When you're mm-hmm. in jail, you can't do that. So we kind of came up with a course that replaced that. So where I got to share the kind of information a college advisor would share with you about career readiness and about self-care and
mm-hmm.
what are you good at, what do you like, how are you going to arrange your life to work towards this goal setting, that kind of stuff. So we actually created a class for that I could then go and give to these students and get some one-on-one conversations in with them and some sort of advising piece in without having to bring them into my office.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how that happened. But we had a couple certificate programs that if you walked out of there, you could be like a Microsoft user or certificate, and we had a networking certificate that we offered as well.
Mm-hmm. And you were an intern chaplain at the hospital as well, right?
Our denomination requires everyone to do clinical pastoral education if you're going to be a minister. So that's one of those competencies that I didn't have a choice about. You have to do. Mm-hmm. It's about 400 hours in a clinical setting, mostly hospitals, although there's other settings you can do it in. So people do it in a jail.
Mm-hmm.
So, I did mine over 20 weeks. There's a 10-week version. There's a one-year version as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you serve as a chaplain in the program with a supervisor and other chaplains. And
mm-hmm. How was that?
It was amazing. It was probably the most formational experience I've ever had. That, put together with my internship, were the two things that made me know I was really ready to do this work. It was intimidating at first because I was in a Catholic hospital, serving with mostly other Christians and of different denominations. They weren't all Catholic, but I served with chaplains of all different backgrounds. And there was a daily prayer every morning over the intercom, and we traded out who did the daily prayer. I was like, oh, crap. And some patients ask you to pray with them. Some patients ask you to do a special ritual with them. There were some things that only the Catholic chaplains could do, but there are a lot of things that anybody could do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was getting used to it. I mean, we had a service once a year for anybody who lost a patient at the hospital. We had another special service for anybody who lost a baby. Learning how to be in that context where I might knock on somebody's door and introduce myself as the chaplain and ask how you're doing and can I do anything for you? And some people are hostile. I don't want no chaplain. Oh, no, I'm not that kind of chaplain. And some people want you to come pray with them to Christ the Healer. And you've got to be open to their language for the holy. And you've got to be open to what they're needing in that moment. Maybe all they need is somebody to listen to their story about how they got sick or about their family or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It might be somebody who's in there because they, OD'd or drank too much, or there's a wide range of things that you run into in a hospital. They might be a person in a hospice room that's going to be there for several weeks dying. You're the person who's there. So in a hospital setting, the chaplain is the person that gets called when somebody dies. And so you walk with the nurse through her paperwork. While the doctor is the one that declares the death, you are actually the one who sits there with the family and goes over things like organ donation, not organ donation, but skin and other kinds mm-hmm. of tissue donation. And you're the one that helps them figure out, have they contacted a mortuary, do they have funeral arrangements? You might be with them to do a last prayer with the family that's gathered. So it's a very intimate, it's kind of brief sometimes because you might not be the person who walks with them after they leave the hospital. But for that brief time that they're in the hospital, if their person is dying or has died, that's a very intense place. And most people, regardless of their background or tradition, I had Catholic families, I'm a female, I'm leading the prayer, they didn't care. They needed somebody to be in that role that was going to bring everybody together, that was going to say the Lord's Prayer, it was going to make everybody hold hands, it was going to sing a song or do something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make it okay for them to grieve and hold that space for them. So my understanding of the role and the sort of what's holy about it? That as human beings, there's places in our lives where we need somebody to hold the space for us so that we can grieve, so that we can celebrate. I don't think growing up, and even as a UU in church contexts, not until I actually needed that did I actually understand how important that role could be. When my daughter was in the hospital, she was in the hospital a bunch when she was little, and she was in ICU for several days and almost had respiratory failure. During that hospitalization, the people who came to me were members of my congregation and my minister. And it was important in a way that I don't think I understood before.
Mm-hmm.
The way that prayer can hold us. You know, you grow up in a secular humanist kind of context where atheism is your embedded religious stance on things. Your sense of what's holy and how to hold space that way is not always developed well.
Mm-hmm.
And CPE definitely creates, and I don't know anybody who hasn't had that experience with CPE, regardless of their religious tradition.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely formational in a way that other experiences were not as, I mean, you know, getting an MDiv is great. I mean,
mm-hmm.
took probably some similar classes to you in your
right.
master's degree. I mean, you're reading the Bible,
mm-hmm.
you're interpreting it, you're reading the Old Testament, you're, you know, doing interreligious dialogue, you know, all these different sort of intellectual pieces, but then here's the reality, you're
mm-hmm.
with a family of 15 and they just lost Papa
mm-hmm.
in his 80s, and they need somebody to step in.
Two very different approaches to studying religion. Yeah.
And you usually don't learn that. I mean, you take a pastoral care class or two, but you actually don't learn how to be in that role till you were just in it.
Mm-hmm.
And people need for you to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know you said your dad is an atheist, but do you like talking about religion with your parents and your family? Is that
yeah? And my mom's a very active member in her UU church, the one that we both joined
mm-hmm.
23 years ago. She's still a member there.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about, my mom and I talk about not just religion intellectually, but we talk about all the ins and outs of church, how a church functions, what a minister does,
mm-hmm.
what a committee does, you know, resources. I mean, she often shares resources with me that are useful and vice versa. So we have a very intimate conversation usually about our two different, and her church is about the same size as mine and has some very, it's also a fellowship and has very similar makeup to mine. So we share a lot. My dad loves to share the intellectual piece because he's read all this stuff. In fact,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if I have them here or if they're at home. He bequeathed to me the Reinhold Niebuhr books. He was so excited to give these to me at my ordination. I was like, yeah, Dad, we're totally going to talk about those someday. But he loves that I'm reading some of the stuff that he loved. He's philosophy guy. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he ended up with a degree in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So intellectually, he enjoys it. He loves that I do what I do. He's enjoyed watching me preach. But he is someone who's never had a church community, not since he was in college.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think really misses that in his life. I don't think he's a runner. He has a community of runners that he hangs out with, and those are his people.
Right.
And I don't know, I sometimes I wonder, okay, is that community, when you hit something really big in your life, so you don't hope for disasters for people, but you wonder when disaster strikes in your life, will that community hold you and walk with you through that? I don't know. I hope so, because that's the community he has, beyond family. So we have good intellectual conversations. I think this is still kind of a weird concept to him that I'm the minister of a church.
Mm. At least he's interested. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they all came out for my ordination, so
mm-hmm.
you know, even people who really were sort of like, I totally don't get this. And when I preach in Wichita, my family in Wichita comes, and some of them are Catholic. Some of them are just not churchy people, but they'll come and listen to me, and they're Kansas nice, right? They're not going to tell me if they think I'm full of shit.
Yeah, the nice Kansans.
That was interesting, honey.
I always pick up on those things.
I think mostly they find it fascinating, and that they see my commitment to making the world a better place, and they think that's good.
Mm-hmm. So what background do most of your other family, so you have family in Kansas, what tradition?
My Kansas family is Methodist and Catholic, so a couple of my family members moved from Catholic to Methodist back to Catholic. John's family, my husband's family, is all grew up Catholic, and he went to Catholic school. My grandparents went to Presbyterian churches most of the time and have had a strong community that way. I don't think they have any theological... I mean, I think they went because they have friends who went there.
Mm-hmm.
They're not like me. We joke that Unitarians are bad hymn singers because they're always reading ahead to see if they agree with the lyrics. This is true. This is totally how I approach church. I read ahead and I'm like, ooh, I can't say that part of the liturgy. I totally don't believe with that. But there's lots of people who... That's not the experience of doing it and saying it. They don't have cognitive dissonance about it. They don't. So, and then my grandparents are like that. They enjoyed being in that community because it was a community that loved on them. So they didn't read ahead to see if they agreed with the words. My mom's family had been Catholic and Methodist. A bunch of them have become Lutherans. I have an uncle who's a Missouri Synod Lutheran minister. So religiously, way more conservative than us, but I think church has created a structure for them. And couple of my cousins ended up going to Lutheran colleges.
Mm-hmm.
So they stayed ongoingly connected to that faith. And one of them actually ended up marrying somebody who went to seminary and became a Lutheran minister. So we don't talk church very much. Mm-hmm. As a result, because our theology is, like, not even in the same... I can talk theology with ELCA Lutherans, fine. Because we connect on the justice work, and we have a similar sense of the whole the universal love of God. The universal salvation thing's not a stopping point for ELCA Lutherans, but I'm pretty sure the Missouri Synod Lutherans do not believe in universal salvation.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't talk theology,
but it's fine. Some of those,
I did the wedding for one of my cousins who grew up without any religious heritage, and they picked me purposely because they wanted a woman, and they didn't want vows that were anti-female or authoritarian.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of my mom's family is not very religious.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like a couple that became Lutherans, and the rest are just sort of church. What?
That's kind of
it's still really weird to them that I'm a minister. Like, they don't even get that I'm like a UU minister, which is like in a totally different realm than, say, a Christian minister they might talk to.
Mm-hmm.
It's still weird because it's church and they don't do church. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. And let's see. Do you think that you have changed really in your point of view on religion or spirituality throughout the years? Have there been any kind of major evolution in your thinking or your approach?
I think the biggest shift for me has been really connecting to how important spiritual practice can be for my health and for my ability to connect to other people. For my ability to hold space as a religious leader, but also how important it is for most people to be able to go out and do the stuff that we do in the world. For me, understanding the grounding possible, and I don't have a rigid sense of spiritual practice, so I'm not somebody who meditates for an hour every day.
Mm-hmm.
I have small spiritual practices that feed me, and then that happen every day, and then I have a few things that I might do once or twice a month. And I try to find ways to make my spirituality and my groundedness be an everyday thing. Sort of the idea of you can wash the dishes and be contemplative and reflective.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I ever understood how important that was. I learned to embrace the idea of prayer as being a way more than just a set of words that somebody taught you to say in a particular order. Mm-hmm. That prayer has to do with how I show up in the world and what intentions I bring to a space.
Mm-hmm.
So I've embraced the idea of prayer being something that I practice. Mm-hmm. I don't practice it the way that other people might imagine it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for me, prayer and spiritual practice are kind of interchangeable. They're similar. They have similar quality to them.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely have developed that over time. I didn't have a sense of a prayer life before.
Right.
Definitely not before seminary. Seminary didn't ingest that for me, but I met people who encouraged me to explore, and that was good.
Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't say that you sit down to pray or...
Yeah, I'm not a sit-downer for the most part. I mean, I do some meditations, but I tend to do prayer walking, singing, movement. Movement helps me move things through my body, and for me, I'm a very head-oriented person, very intellectual, so doing something that gets me out of my head is usually necessary, and I don't get out of my head if I'm sitting down. It's really hard to get out of my head when I'm sitting down. Reading poetry can be that way. Working in the garden can be spiritual practice or prayer.
So interacting with nature.
Yeah, and you know, it's just like anything else. It can be totally not mindful and so not a spiritual practice, or it can be totally mindful. I mean, I can interact with it in a way that is grounding, or I can interact with it in a way that is not.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's the... You can turn almost anything into a prayer or a spiritual practice by how you approach it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm probably... I tell my members that smiling at people is the most basic prayer we can share with people. And they're always like, wow. And then they smile at each other and it's like, oh, I felt that. That's true.
There's something to it.
So I like things that get me out of my words.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have to talk a lot.
Yeah. Comes with the job, yeah.
It does. So anything that doesn't involve...
You signed up for it.
I did.
And, I mean, you talked about being an intern chaplain in the hospital and working in the jail and all of that, but are there any other kinds of major experiences or just people that you've interacted with that have really... had a major impact on you that stand out above other things, maybe?
Well, the experience of having my kid in the hospital every year for the first 4 years of her life, at least once or twice, shifted my understanding of interdependence in a way. I think I'd always seen myself as being very capable of handling things myself, and... that shifted my capacity in multiple ways. My financial capacity, my spiritual capacity, just my physical exhaustion, my connection to my spouse. There was nothing in my life that did not rock in some important way. And so understanding how important community was to me and how to receive. I think a lot of our culture teaches us how to give. It's so important to give, but it's also important to receive.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell people now, it's important that you give, but it's also important that you be open to receiving, because that allows somebody else to give. And if there's nobody that's open to receiving, then your giving is meaningless because there's nobody there to receive it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something holy about that I don't think I understood before. Had a couple professors at ILF that made huge impact on my theology and how I see myself as a minister. One taught I think of her as sort of the spiritual end of the spectrum, and she, her classes weren't required, but they were awesome. What was her last name? Jane Vinard. She's written a bunch of books. But she taught how to plan a contemplative retreat, and I got to do a contemplative retreat with her. She taught spirituality, spiritual practice, and prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Things that later became really useful for me in a way that some of the other stuff I learned was, I don't preach from the Bible every weekend, so maybe once or twice a year I might pull out some actual biblical text and play with it, but most of the time I'm not preaching from scripture, so it's great that I took them. I know what's in there now. There was somebody else I had thought of. So the other one taught pastoral counseling and or pastoral care. I don't remember what we called it. I don't know if I remember his name either. But the book that he wrote that really moved me, sort of called Care of Persons, Care of World, Larry Graham. Mm-hmm. His theological perspective was that each of us is part of a context. And so if I'm only caring for you and I'm not paying attention to the context you're in, this is a problem. And conversely, if I'm only out there doing justice work looking at the context, I might miss the important impacts of how that is for you, how that lands for you as an individual. Mm-hmm. So the way in which the outer and the inner connect, the way in which you can be doing justice work by how you do your pastoral care.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I understood that before I took his class as deeply as I did after taking it.
Mm-hmm.
That understanding a person's context makes a world of difference in how you might reach out to them. And even from that, so here I am in the hospital, and I think to myself, every room I go into, each person's going to have a different relationship with God or not God.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have different language for it, different experiences, different expectations. How do I know how to be with you in the hospital if I don't know that information about you? How can I get that from you? So I don't know that I would have thought that way if I hadn't had that class and hadn't had to think through some people's context impacts how they can be cared for.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I've asked all of the big questions I had originally intended to ask, but do you have any final, any lingering thoughts or comments or some note you'd really like to finish on? Some final mark you'd like to make?
I can't think of any.
No.
I'm fascinated that this work is being done, and I'm so grateful to be in conversation with somebody about it. Every time I talk about my journey, it helps me reflect on what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. So I kind of appreciate the moment to reconnect with, okay, how did I get here to be a minister, and why am I doing it, and where do I hope to go?
Well, I appreciate you sitting down to talk with us.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
So I'll have to go listen to some of the other interviews now online, huh?
Yes, yeah. I still haven't published any yet, but yeah, they should be posted in the near future. And I can send this to you if you'd like before I get it up there.
I don't need to hear it before, but once it's up, you can send me the link. That'd be cool.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You're so welcome.